We kick off this 5 o'clock hour as we do every Tuesday afternoon by welcoming into the show our friend, writer, and critic, the talented Colin Fleming. Colin, good afternoon.
How's it going, my friend?
Wonderful, thank you. How's your day so far?
Just did 5 mighty climbs of the Bunker Hill Monument, so I'm in fighting fettle for you today.
Well, you own that monument. There's no question about it. So you've got a new short story out. It's in the publication Glimmer Train. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. The story is called Last Light Out, and Glimmer Train is based out in Oregon. And it's one of these literary journals that I think does a good job, much better than most of them, in terms of crossing over to people out in the actual world, giving them work that they can enjoy. A lot of times, it's very hermetic, these journals. In fact, I find that if you have a story, and the more people will like that story and connect with that story and be entertained by that story and be moved at the core of who they are by that story, the harder it will be to place a story with one of these very hermetic, sort of pretentious, jejune literary magazines. This is not one of them, though.
Well, and I got to tell you, the story is, it's absolutely wonderful. Is it Last Light Out or is it Last Light Out?
I think it's the former. When you look at it and you then read it, it becomes the latter, where I can't really think of another story where the pronunciation of the title changes. What happens really is there's kind of an elision. When you first look at it, like Last Light Out, you think that light's a noun. But the noun is actually a verb, and it's almost like one of those acrostic poems like E.E. Cummings would do, like Grasshopper or whatever, because a light switch, in a sense, functions in this story. So it's a kind of titular pun where the title itself is flipped, like a light switch in a way.
And I don't want to give away too much because I want people to read it. It's so good, but it involves a widower and his daughter and some friends and the relationship as everybody tries to sort things out and moves forward. But there, man, there are just some wonderful, wonderful scenes. And I don't know, nothing hit me more in this story, Colin, than the description of the room that our narrator designs for his daughter, Morris.
Right. This narrator, Evan, his wife has died, and she had a brain situation going on that caused her to say a number of things that may or may not have been true. So the narrator is an oral surgeon for the New Jersey Devils, the hockey team, and he is frequently away from home. And what he decides with his wife, what they decide together, is that they're going to try to keep this as quiet as they can from their daughter, Morris, that the wife, the mom, might be not long for the world. They're sort of hoping against hope that that won't be the case. And she sort of puts out there some juicy allegations, maybe about fidelity or about parentage, paternity, things of that nature. And the daughter, when the mom does die, sort of blames the father. It's almost like there's a way that we can die not quite right. Sometimes in the eyes of, you know, when we have a loved one go, it's almost like we want it to be, sounds like horribly morbid, but like the right way. And the daughter feels that the father might not have played his proper part in having that be the right way. So they have this house together. He has a daughter now. They're in this situation. And he's bought a new house, and not in New Orleans, but not too far away. And he kind of wants to start over there. And he has a friend named Cam, and he used to date Cam's wife. And you mentioned that scene in terms of the new bedroom of the new house. The scene to me that, like, I was looking over this story before coming on the air today, it's the most heartbreakingly erotic scene, I think, in all of literature, what happens in that kitchen with this guy's, his ex, in a sense. It is this scene of transference for his deceased wife that it's like arousing in a way, but it just makes you an absolute puddle on the ground that this is happening. And it's a kind of infidelity, but in a way it's also not a form of infidelity for anyone involved. And how often do you ever really have that? And it's just, I'm looking at that, I'm thinking like, oh my God, you wrote that. Wow.
Well, yeah, because without giving away too much, it's this, I don't know, in many ways it's this wonderful gift, I guess you could say, an attempt at healing by this woman he had been in a relationship with, and at the same time, you know, it can never be what he wants it to be.
No, it's one of those things that, like, if it's taught in the class and you ask the class about it, everyone raises their hand and wants to weigh in on kind of like, is that actual sequence, is that wrong? Did someone do something immoral in it? And it's one of those kind of like, you almost want to put it to like Kant, right? Whole categorical imperative, and there are no absolutes, and nothing is relative, which I tend to agree with. And I don't think anyone does anything wrong in that sequence, but you have a lot of things in the story where it's subtle distinctions. Like early on, the narrator is saying there's a big difference between looking and staring. Looking is what you do when you want to find out something that you didn't know before. Sometimes that's the meaning held in someone else's face and their expression, their smile, their eyes. So often in the eyes. Sometimes it's the way you've never seen a bird move that maybe tells you something about how a bird might think, which maybe tells you something about how you ought to try and think. Staring is what you do when you're desiccated inside. It's like there's not enough moisture in your body to make your eyes move about in their sockets so they can properly pivot and take in the world. That's gone. It's sawdust in those sockets instead, and you keep your head steady to ensure that those dried up orbs don't fall right out of your face, because you've already lost so much, and losing some more could result in there being nothing left of you. And you're just invisible. No one can see you. No one can hear you scream. Living ghost. So you try to hold on to your eyes in a manner of speaking. And that's a theme that comes up over and over again in different sort of iterations, different modulations, different keys in the story. These little distinctions that really we don't think hold that much dramatically in terms of contrast in our life, but it's the very actual life guts itself.
We're talking with Colin Fleming here on Downtown. His new short story in Glimmer Train is entitled Last Light Out. The other thing that I noticed about this story, and in an earlier short story we talked with you about, is the role that people who are not parents often play in the parenting process, that we all seem to have these surrogates in our life that contribute so much to the raising of children and the influences that they get.
If we're fortunate, I think we do. I think oftentimes people don't have that, but there's a high degree of fluidity to relationships, and that's why I think labels can be massively misleading. Like we've talked about before, I don't think there's anything more powerful in human existence in terms of connection than a friendship, and I think a friendship is almost like, it's like the blues is the root of jazz. Friendship is the root of human connection. And a story like this, it becomes a surrogate itself. It becomes a friend unto the reader. And the daughter becomes a kind of mother, doesn't she?
Right.
To the father. She plays this role where there is this other tragedy in the story that is completely shocking. And the daughter steps in with this ex-girlfriend, really, of the narrator to do something that is impressively maternal. In her father isn't even really quite primed to see that. It's this epiphany for him. And so when we do away with labels, when we have the courage to do away with labels, I find that that becomes hugely freeing, and we can move towards friendship, which is also a kind of art. So I think when you have a story, what you really want to have too is that this idea that these people are out there, they aren't actually down your street, but they can be more real than the people down your street. So when I write something like this and someone's like, oh, how did you come up with that? You didn't go through anything like that. It's like I'm on my walk or I'm doing my climbs in the Bunker Hill Monument, and you get the characters and eventually you get their names. And then they drive the bus. They take care of what's going to happen. They tell you the direction it's going to go in, and you just become this sort of transcriber. Maybe you let them play in your head over a few weeks as you're walking around, but eventually, when you're done walking around and they're done talking, to you. All you have to do is sit down and wiggle your fingers, and boom, there it is.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that, Colin, because we've talked with you about this notion that in some quarters that you have to have experienced the things that you write about, and you have to have the perspective of the people involved, and how silly that is in the big picture. But it's not just capturing these characters that, and I'm not just saying this because you're a great friend of the show, but man, you are able to nail the dialogue and the vocal patterns of people who are not you, including in this case the daughter Morris, and that's to me that's such a rare thing to find in literature, people that can capture different voices.
I feel like I know them, and I've hung out with someone like that. What a lot of writers do, and I feel like what every writer in the world does right now. That's part of the reason literature is in the state it's in. It's part of the reason I work my 130 hours a week to try and get it beyond this current stage, is they write from the outside. Like, you have a soap bubble, and you are outside the soap bubble, and you're trying to, like, get into it, and that's never going to work. You have to write from the inside out. So I can have what to you would look like absolutely nothing. I could have, like, on a page, I could have, like, the word lettuce. I could have the name of a female character. I could have, like, a phrase that I'm going to make into a title. And I see in those three things, when I am on the inside, I already have it. I have that story completely, even though I don't know what's going to happen. I just have to be myself and let these people take me where they're going to take me. And then there's a kind of musicality to the language, because when all of these other writers are like, oh, yeah, I'm studying David Foster Wallace. It's so fascinating, and I'm being inspired by this. It's like, no, you're not. He's terrible. It's just word soup stuff. I got my pull, so to speak, from music. I learned to write from, like, A Hard Day's Night, and not the lyrics, but the modulations, the key changes. I heard words in that, and so I'm always able to get the sonics exactly spot on as they would be if you were sitting in. These people couldn't see you, and they were living their lives, having their conversations as you just witnessed it.
Want to mention the website, too, and we talked about it a little bit, but you continue to make upgrades and additions to it. Colin Fleming Lit, all one word, colinflemminglit.com, and the blog, and really a lot of wonderful things, including your segments here on Downtown, are featured on that website.
Right. I wanted it to be... A lot of times a writer will maybe, like, publish something once every 4 years. And let's face it, every writer is like, they do one thing. It's like, oh, I birthed short shorts, or I write about Revolutionary War stuff, or I'm, like, classical music person. What I wanted was an interactive digital museum where you could come in and you could be like, you know what, I'm just going to look at these Beatles writings. I'm going to look at these things on sports. I'm going to look at these literary writings. I just want to listen to a lot of audio clips where it's like you go to the MFA and you have the American Wing and you have the Impressionist Gallery. I wanted something like that because I do have a unique career. No one really, it's like Sherlock Holmes, right? People be like, well, what do you do? It's like, well, it's complicated. I'm not this and I'm not that. I'm just, follow me around. You'll see it. But people don't usually write on hockey and then write on jazz and do a short story and then do an op-ed for the Wall Street Journal that I just did and talk on the radio. So I wanted something where people could come in and have a digital museum, and then a blog where I'm documenting what I'm doing, how I came to write something, the corruption in publishing, or just how disgusting my sweatshirt looks after I've sweated through it going up the monument five straight times.
Well, go to the blog, go to the website, colinflemminglit.com, and make sure you read Last Light Out. It really is a wonderful, powerful story. Colin, great stuff. Thank you so much, as always, for being with us.
Okay, thank you.
We'll see you next time. It's Colin Fleming every Tuesday afternoon here on Downtown.